Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with playwright Gary Graves and director Jan Zweifler about the world premiere of the Kafka-esque political comedy Wonderland at Central Works in Berkeley. Choreographer Katie Faulkner shares details about the world premiere of Divining by her Little Seismic Dance Company, opening the 2019 ODC Dance Theater season tonight. I'll also visit with San Francisco Ballet's principal dancer, Luke Ingham, who performs in Tony Award winner Justin Peck's Hurry Up, We're Dreaming, part of SF Ballet's Program 2, Kaleidoscope, which runs through February 23rd. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, shines his unique light on the Monet exhibition at the De Young. And Renee Kemp contributes to this week's show with a conversation with Maxine Gordon, carrying on the legacy of her late husband, the late great saxophone player Dexter Gordon. Maxine celebrates Dexter's birthday on the 27th with a visit to Mills College for a talk and gala celebration. Lots to come on Open Air. Stay with us. That's music created by local composer Ben Yudvalkis, created for Divining, a work choreographed by Katie Faulkner, receiving its world premiere to open ODC Theater's 2019 season, opening tonight, in fact, through Saturday at ODC in the Mission. Katie Faulkner joined me in studio. Divining is a physical investigation of embodied forms of knowing, from prayer to palm reading to water witching, and is Faulkner's first full evening-length work. Katie is an award-winning choreographer who has served distinguished artist residencies with ODC, the Maggie Alice National Center for Choreography, the Rauschenberg Residency, and the Headland Center for the Arts. Before forming Little Seismic Dance Company in 2006, Katie was a member of Axis Dance Company and is currently on the faculty at UC Berkeley, the University of San Francisco, as well as Stanford. Katie, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So, Katie, a personal fascination with the act of divining, what led you to create a full evening-length work on the idea?
You know, it's a good question. I don't actually have a...
I don't know who else to ask.
I don't personally engage with any specific divining rituals or practices, but I came upon
whoever
the
was,
idea.
It certainly worked this week. I don't maybe some of the dancers is what has caused this.
Maybe so. Gosh, I know. Just endless amounts of rain. I actually came upon the idea for this when I was looking through a stack of photos last Christmas. I was putting together a calendar for my mom, and I came across a photo of a water witcher that my parents had hired to come and try to find a well water on our property that we had purchased out in the tobacco country in North Carolina. And I saw the picture, and it didn't, you know, I kind of thought it was interesting and funny to think about. And
well, explain what water witching is for people that may not even know.
So water witching is a dousing practice where people use anything from sticks, sort of Y-shaped sticks, to dousing rods, which are sort of L-shaped metal rods. And the people who practice it purport to be able to use these rods to essentially locate water, and they walk holding these rods, and they will sort of follow the behavior of the rods, not unlike a Ouija board, to lead them toward what they consider to be the source for this water. And
interesting. Yeah. I should have "It's Witchcraft" underneath this instead of Ben Yudvalkis' music. "It's Witchcraft."
Yeah. You know, I mean, what was interesting to me about it is this was way back in the early 90s. The guy that we hired was this, you know, good old boy, country boy that lived out in, you know, the rural North Carolina. He had a cigar hanging out of his mouth the whole time. And, you know, and I thought about it, and I thought, you know, that's exactly the kind of intuitive, embodied ritual that women have been burned at the stake for centuries, you know. And I just thought that was compelling to me, this idea of that there are ways that people engage in these intuitive rituals, sometimes with materials, sometimes not, but that the materials are intended to be conduits to connect the body to some sort of hidden source or power or resource. And that this man, as he was walking, yes, he was following the stick, but he was also following sensation in his own body as related to the action of this stick. And, you know, to me, that felt like the perfect metaphor for choreography, which is so much about tuning the body to locate things of meaning and things of, you know, and resources.
That's a great metaphor. You also write that this is an intentionally spare production, so we can actually focus on the dancers.
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of conversations over the course of the process wherein we considered bringing in materials and things and, you know, trying to more directly refer to the materiality of rituals. And then I just ultimately decided that this is really ultimately about the body, and that we should allow the body to do the work, and that we should trust that the body can be communicative of potent ideas, and that we don't need to dress it up.
So tell us then, who will we be seeing on stage?
So you're going to see four extraordinary dancers. They're all Bay Area dancers, although two of them not for long, sadly. Their names are Tara MacArthur, Suzette Sagisi, Chin Chin Hugh, and Alex Carrington.
And you've worked with these folks before, I imagine.
Part of
Little Seismic.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Little Seismic has been around since 2006, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And what's happening after this grand opening? What are you working on?
Well, that's a great question. I have no idea. I really don't know.
That's usually a more dangerous question for an actor than it is for a choreographer, because choreographers always seem to have something up their sleeves.
I mean, it takes a lot to pull these things together, and I like taking time.
Well, we'll keep close to littleseismicdance.org for more information about that, and the ODC opening, odc.dance/divining. ODC is at 3153 17th Street in the Mission. And performances tonight through Saturday. We're going to go out with more of the music of Ben Yudvalkis that's going to be part of Divining. But, you know, Katie, inquiring minds want to know, was your family diviner successful in North Carolina?
I think so. Actually, I think so. Yeah, pretty cool.
Thanks for taking some time, Katie.
Thank you.
Do not adjust your radio. That is intentionally the way Ben Yudvalkis created this music for Divining. World premiere choreography by Katie Faulkner. Again, LittleSeismicDance.org for more information, as well as odc.dance/divining. Opening tonight through Saturday at ODC in the Mission. Well, also with us today, we have playwright Gary Graves and director Jan Zweifler from the Central Works production of Wonderland, a Kafkaesque comedy by Gary Graves, opening on Saturday and running through March 17th at the Berkeley City Club. Gary Graves has been a resident playwright and company co-director at Central Works since 1998 and has helped develop some 62 world premiere productions with the company, many of which he has written and or directed. He also leads the Central Works playwriting program and teaches playwriting regularly at the Berkeley Rep School of Theater. Welcome, Gary.
Pleasure to be here, David.
Indeed. Joined by director Jan Zweifler, a founding member of the company and co-director of Central Works, along with Gary. Over the past 28 seasons, she has participated as actor, designer, director, and or producer, and has worked with many other local theater companies as well, including Berkeley Rep, Berkeley Shakespeare Festival, the Marin Theater Company, the San Francisco Playwrights Foundation, and San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. Welcome to you, Jan.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Gary, this is described as Lewis Carroll meets Franz Kafka. Is it possible to give us a brief synopsis?
Yeah, maybe we could go a little further. It's Franz Kafka meets Alice from Wonderland in the White House.
Okay.
The story unfolds in a place which appears to be the White House. We borrow the premise for the trial, which is that a man wakes up one morning and he's, for no obvious reason, arrested. But no one will tell him what he's been arrested for. And he finds himself in a place that appears to be the White House, and he soon realizes that he's implicated in some sort of nefarious plot that's unfolding, and he has to determine what to do about that.
All right. I sense perhaps not only a little Kafka, but maybe some Samuel Beckett influence here.
Well, we kind of crossed Alice in Wonderland and the trial, Kafka in particular, the trial. They share an interesting sense of absurdity, both works do. That took us down a strange rabbit hole, which was the development of the play.
Appropriately so.
Mixed in with the influence of a number of recent political events, and if you think about the White House, it's not a stretch to imagine Alice in Wonderland as a kind of metaphor for the craziness that appears to be going on there.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, if anyone has taught us any more than anyone else is that in this administration anyone can be president, the Mad Hatter included.
Yeah, there's a Mad Hatter in our play too.
Well, several, fair to say, many of your past plays have dealt with historical figures in some way or another. Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of twist on that.
I would the play. Yes, the play deals with historical figures, but in a very veiled way. It seems in this plot that's unfolding, all the figures in it are using code names that appear to be drawn from Alice in Wonderland. So there is a Mad Hatter, and there is someone with the initial A, and there's a duchess and a cook and a red king and a red queen, but we don't exactly know who they are. As the play unfolds, we can deduce who they might be, and by the end, some of them are pretty clearly determined. But
It's Gary Graves, author of Wonderland at Central Works, Berkeley City Club, through the 17th of March. Also joined by director Jan Zweifler. Jan, you're no doubt familiar with Gary's works. Is this an unusual one, even for Gary, or what you expected?
Well, there always are a lot of things that come up as surprises with Gary's work. But Gary and I have worked together for a long time, and we have worked as director and playwright on, gosh, I haven't counted, quite a few productions. So I would say it was not entirely unexpected, but there's always a few surprise turns.
Well, tell us a little bit about your cast and maybe about your casting process for this.
We have a great cast, wonderfully talented people for the show. They're all local. Martha Brigham, John Patrick Moore, Kimberly Ridgway, and Clive Worsley are all featured in the production. What's interesting is we have this method that we aptly named the Central Works Method, which is how we develop our plays much of the time.
You read my questions. That was going to be my next question.
Oh, go so, figure.
Go on.
And what's interesting is the premise of the Central Works Method is that you have an understanding about a topic and maybe some general ideas about what the play is going to be about, but no words are written, and the characters aren't necessarily clearly drawn at the time that we begin our workshops for developing the script, but we do have to have a cast in place. So we basically say, how about we have four actors in the show this time? And how about it's two male, two female? And who would we like to work with? And it's a very different process from what you typically do, where you have a very specific character and you're looking for somebody who will fulfill that role. What we have is actors, and we're writing characters to fulfill their talents and abilities in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And is this a regular pool of players that is drawn on in Central Works, or is it kind of an open casting situation?
We tend to go with both. In this instance, mm-hmm. we have two actors who have worked with us before. In fact, John Patrick Moore is essentially a resident actor. He's with the company, and he's worked on many of John's plays before. And then we have someone named Clive Worsley, who's a wonderful local talent who has worked with us before. The other two, Martha Brigham and Kimberly Ridgway, this is their first time working with us.
Mm-hmm. And to both of you, how much visually do we actually go down the rabbit hole? What will we be seeing on stage?
Well, John paints a very vivid picture of his trip through a kind of rabbit hole, which is the journey that he's been brought on, how he got to the place, the room in this old mansion that appears to be the White House. We hear how he got here. So it's our version of his down the rabbit hole, that part of the story. It's a pretty rough ride. They arrest him. They don't tell him what he's arrested for. They put a bag over his head. They drive him in, and two strange guys dressed in overcoats and hats, like they look like gangsters. They drive him in an old station wagon into a garage somewhere. They take him down a long set of metal stairs into an underground long concrete corridor, and then up some stairs, and then he finds himself here. So that, and he goes into a lot of detail of that. His name is Joseph K. as well. That's also drawn from Kafka's The Trial. That's the central character in Kafka's Trial. The difference is, in Kafka, the K is just an initial, and many people tend to assume the last name K is an initial that stands for Kafka, that just never got changed or was left like that. Our character is Joseph K. His last name is spelled K-A-Y-E. And he suspects that's the source of the confusion, because they're looking for someone with a code name K, just the letter K, and he suspects there's been a mix-up. And that explains the mistaken circumstances under which he's arrived in this place. But there are conflicting arguments about that in the play, about whether he's the right guy or the wrong guy.
If I can interject with regard to the set in the setting. This Berkeley City Club where we work is a very mm-hmm. it's a very small sort of salon room. We have 50 seats, two rows in a U around a playing area. We try to take advantage of the amazing Julia Morgan architecture of the building and the room. So it becomes almost a little bit site-specific. Mm-hmm. The audience is in the room with the characters. Literally, the walls of the room are behind them. So there's no such thing as breaking the fourth wall because they're in front of it. But we have a tendency in general, because of the configuration of the room, and also it's very small, we have no sides or wings or backstage, to keep things very, very minimal. And as a result, it's all about words and sound. We have an incredible resident sound designer named Gregory Sharpin, who's award-winning in a lot of different areas of expertise. But soundscapes and interesting lighting and very minimal sets are part of what we do to try to highlight the words and the play, since mm-hmm. we're doing new work as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of new work, you and Gary co-founded Central Works some 20 years ago and have worked with some of the great talents in the region, mm-hmm. Supporting and launching scores of writers and performers committed to new works, and for the most part inspired by social issues as well mm-hmm. as classical texts mm-hmm. and history. From your viewpoint, how has this playwriting evolved? Is there a new good crop of writers? I mean, speak for yourself, Gary. Maybe you should.
Well, I it's better for Gary to speak to that, because he is a facilitator.
One of the nurturers.
Yeah. Central Works Writers Workshop, and much of the work that we're doing is, in fact, coming out of that workshop with local playwrights.
And how does the workshop work?
Well, we develop plays in all sorts of different ways. As Jan described, our what we call the Central Works method. But we also develop plays in what's called the Central Works Writers Workshop, which is we invite eight writers twice a year in a 12-week workshop to develop works with us. Some of our new plays come from there. We also sometimes we're part of the National New Play Network, and we do what's called rolling world premieres once in a while, which are world premieres that are shared with other theaters that are a member of this national organization called the National New Play Network. And sometimes we get plays over the transom, and we just do a new play that's already developed. But usually we develop a play, and any time a play is being done for the first time, there's going to be some degree of development in rehearsal, if not before.
Budding playwrights should go to centralworks.org to get on that bus, maybe part of the Playwriters Workshop. Central Works Wonderland, the Kafka-esque comedy by Gary Graves, opens Saturday, runs through March 17th at the Berkeley City Club on Durant Avenue in Berkeley. centralworks.org for more information. Gary Graves, Jan Zweifler, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Have a great run. San Francisco Ballet continues its season with Program 2, Kaleidoscope, which includes the choreography of George Balanchine from 1956 to music of Mozart from 1777, which we're hearing in the background. His Divertimento number 15, also on the program, Benjamin Millepied's Appassionata, set to the Beethoven Piano Sonata of the same surname, number 23 in F minor, and concluding with Tony Award winner Justin Peck's Hurry Up, We're Dreaming, returning to the ballet after debuting in the 2018 Unbound Festival of New Works. Among the dancers involved with that work is San Francisco Ballet principal dancer Luke Ingham. I caught up with him earlier this week at the San Francisco Ballet's headquarters on Franklin Street. Luke Ingham, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Justin Peck's Hurry Up, We're Dreaming takes its title from the electronic band M83's album of the same name. Were you familiar at all with their work prior to this?
To be honest, completely honest, no. My musical tastes extend to probably mostly Pink Floyd, a little bit of Led Zeppelin.
Tchaikovsky, maybe?
Tchaikovsky, you know, work-related, obviously. Yeah.
So Justin says that the work is about how we dream as children, how we dream as young coming of age of adults, and how we dream as fully matured adults. How are those stages depicted on stage?
Well, I think for me personally, I feel like my particular pas de deux is very much like a coming of age pas de deux. Like, it's not quite romantic. There's a lot of moments where we're interacting, but there's not a lot of like really direct eye contact. It kind of builds in a way to be quite kind of energetic towards the end. It starts off very slowly and then it builds and builds and builds. So it kind of gives a sense of transition.
And it's danced in sneakers, so that must be so much more comfortable for you.
It is. It's really fun. It's definitely works really well with the movement quality that we use. It's certain kind of, especially with the partnering, it feels almost like swing dancing. So it's kind of definitely works well with that. But it did take a little while to get used to working in shoes, especially in my particular pas de deux, where we're doing a lot more kind of like lifting. And so it was kind of interesting at first. You sort of, it felt different to partner in shoes, like, because we're used to wearing ballet shoes, so our feet are really like planted to the ground, whereas in shoes you kind of, I felt like a lot of the time I was like tensing my feet in the shoes to kind of stay balanced.
Well, this is the second work for the San Francisco Ballet that Justin has created. The work had its start as a part of an SF Ballet commission as last year's Unbound series, the other work being In Countenance of Kings. So how did this relationship start with Justin Peck, and do you see a particular style that he brings to his work?
Yeah, so fortunately for us, Helgi, obviously our director, got Justin in, and fortunately for me, I was picked to kind of be a part of his original piece. I didn't know a lot about Justin at that point. I'd obviously been aware of Rodeo. I'd heard a lot about Rodeo and how fantastic that was and how well received it was in New York. So being given the opportunity to work with him was really exciting. He has a very unique movement kind of vocabulary, which is kind of like a long way away from anything that's like neoclassical or ballet that we do here. So yeah, it was really exciting and a new experience when he first came. And obviously over time, you and through working with him more and more, you become a lot more familiar with his style and just how creative he is.
A little more athletic, perhaps, or more formal, or how would you describe it?
I think it's athletic. There's kind of, it's very kind of sharp movement. It's very like structured. Like, I love the way that he kind of structures his groups, like the group dances and everything. It's really interesting. It's very kind of, you get a real sense that everyone's kind of working together. Mm-hmm.
Well, he's someone to certainly keep an eye on. 2018 Tony for his work on the revival of Carousel. He choreographed the feature film Red Sparrow and will be the new choreographer and do the new choreography for the upcoming film remake of West Side Story, directed by Steven Spielberg. That's going to be something to watch.
That's pretty amazing. I obviously have seen the Broadway show of West Side Story and love it. So I'm really excited to see what he's able to do with the choreography.
Your previous work, you're a principal dancer now with the San Francisco Ballet, having previously been with both the Australian and the Houston Ballet, where Helgi Thomasson, I guess, found you.
Well, actually, I kind of found Helgi and San Francisco Ballet. So I first encountered San Francisco Ballet back in 2005, I think it was. So I was a young dancer at the Australian Ballet, and I was offered a scholarship to kind of travel around the world and see different companies. So I started out in P&B and then went across to New York, got to see shows, both companies, dance shows in New York, did classes there, went up to Toronto, and then the last stop was San Francisco Ballet. And that coming here definitely left the kind of greatest imprint on my mind. The company was just amazing. Like from the quarter ballet soloist to principal level, it was just the most kind of well-rounded and talented company that I saw. And ever since then, it kind of stuck in my mind that this would be a place that I would love to try and dance at one day. And then in 2009, I came out here to dance with Morphosis, Chris Wilden. He set up a small company. And yeah, I kind of got in contact with Helgi then, and then things didn't really work out at the time. I left the Australian Ballet, went to Houston, and then decided that I still kind of had the itch to come here, and ended up here in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating. It's like a dance in itself, that audition process. You're both, you know, that scholarship enabled you to test the waters in different areas.
Yeah, I think as a dancer, you kind of, you know, you track your career path, but there's always going to be little forks in the road. For me, at various times, there was injuries, you know, that really make you kind of think about what you want out of your career. Like, for me, I often think about what, you know, what's at the end of the road sometimes, and I want to look back and say that I got the most out of myself.
Well, you're fortunate to be dancing with your wife, Denny Rowe, here, also from Australia. That has got to be a wonderful happenstance of fate.
Yeah, so she's a freelance choreographer based, obviously, here in San Francisco. We danced together in the Australian Ballet and then in Houston Ballet. When I left to come here, she decided that she wanted to move to Holland and dance with Netherlands Dance Theatre. So that's a contemporary company that features works by Paul Lightfoot and Sol Leon, and a very internationally kind of famous choreographer, Yuri Killian. So she went there for 3 years. We obviously kept our relationship going long distance, and then she decided that she was ready to retire, so she moved back to San Francisco. And we had a baby, so I now have a 2.5-year-old daughter at home, Aggie. So, hey, Aggie, if you're listening. so it's kind of been great.
That's wonderful. So I've always wanted to ask a question of a principal dancer. You need some crazy discipline to maintain your body and maintain a performance schedule like this. Are you crazy disciplined, or are you more like a Michael Phelps who can, you know, have an incredible workout and then go wolf down a half a dozen cheeseburgers?
I wish that I was crazy disciplined. I think that you definitely, we go through phases where we really have to manage things. So it being the start of our season, it kind of feels like we're at the start of the marathon. So we just finished, we had our opening gala in January and then Don Q, and now we move on to more of the rep, the triple bills and stuff like that. So my workload right now is quite heavy, of 4 ballets out of the 6 ballets. And then the next program is Sleeping Beauty. So I perform the lead in Sleeping Beauty. So that's a full-length ballet. So
the male lead.
The male lead, yeah, not Aurora. No, I don't spend half the ballet asleep. So yeah, it's kind of, and then this year we're actually traveling to London to perform at Sadler's Wells. So that's kind of tacked on to the end of the season. So we don't finish till June. So we perform all of our ballet, all of our rep from January through till June this year. And I think I'm performing in the season 12 ballets. And then in London, I think it's about 6 ballets. So yeah, it's kind of pacing yourself, yeah, at the right times. And I think certain points of the year, like, it's more of an off-season time where I kind of need to manage my diet a little more. But right now, it's kind of, if you feel like eating something, you know, just kind of do.
Luke Ingham performing in Hurry Up, We're Dreaming, as well as several other ballets for the rest of the season. 5 remaining performances of Hurry Up, We're Dreaming, choreographed by Justin Peck. It's part of Kaleidoscope, Program 2 of the San Francisco Ballet, tomorrow night through the 23rd of February. sfballet.org for more information. Luke, thanks so much for taking some time today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Great American saxophone player Dexter Gordon, who left this world in 1990, left this world an incredible treasure trove of jazz recordings from a performance career that spanned some 40 years. He was among the first of the bebop era of musicians such as Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and Bud Powell, and at 6 feet 6 inches, truly was a sophisticated giant. Coincidentally, the title of a loving and informative biography penned by Dexter's widow, Maxine Gordon, who is herself an accomplished arts advocate, jazz historian, archivist, scholar, manager, and producer. She began her career in jazz as a road manager for Gil Evans, and after an illustrious career on the road in various capacities, she now gives lectures in the U.S. and abroad on bebop and Dexter Gordon, on expat jazz musicians, and other related subjects associated with her work on Dexter Gordon. She'll be at Mills College on Wednesday, February 27th, for a Dexter Gordon birthday celebration, discussion, and book reading. Renee Kemp caught up with her prior to her cross-country flight from New York.
Maxine Gordon, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to join you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sophisticated Giant. What a great title. And I'm sure that there's a story behind the title. So tell us where that title came from.
The title comes from an album that Dexter recorded for Columbia Records when he returned from Europe after 14 years living there. And it was his idea, dream, one of those dream ideas where he said to Bruce Lundvall, the president of Columbia Records, I'd like to make a big band, or it's really 11 pieces, a large group record, and I want Slad Hampton to do the arrangements, and I want Benny Bailey, and I want this one and that one and Bobby Hutcherson. And Bruce Lundvall said, whatever you want. And Dexter said, that's never happened before. And so he made this album, which turned out to be one of his favorite albums. And then, of course, he's referred, since he was 6'6", he's referred to as the sophisticated giant.
And, I mean, just looking at photographs of him and, of course, in the film Round Midnight, it could be said he was a tall drink of water, handsome,
yes, he was.
Striking. How did you meet him?
I met him in 1975 in Europe. I was a road manager for a booking agent in Holland, and I traveled all over Europe with bands, and if there was a problem in travel, they would send me, and because the bands travel by train, and no cell phone, no internet, so I had this gigantic book of train schedules in Europe. And when I met Dexter, he said, is that the only book you read? Because I was always studying the book, the train book, but there was a problem with his band, and they were in Nancy, France, and had to get to Copenhagen, and there was a strike. There's often a train strike in Europe. And so they sent me there, and I'd never met him. It was 1975, and then, you know, I had the Dexter Gordon moment. In the book, there's a story about when he first went to Copenhagen, and a famous tennis player, Torben Ulrich, went to hear him, and he fainted.
And wow.
He said that was like the ultimate Dexter Gordon moment. So anyway, I had the Dexter Gordon moment, and we started talking about him coming back and to the States, and he did come back, and first I was his manager, and then I was his wife.
Did you know the extent of his talent when you first met him? I mean, when you went there, you were just there to handle logistics, train schedules, and such. After having the moment, was it based on just knowing that he, in fact, was considered a prodigy, a real genius in bebop? Did you know all that about him?
Oh, yeah. No, I was a little jazz girl. Yeah, no, we grew up listening to him, but he had left. He left the country in 1962, and so I was too young. I mean, I never heard him before. Then, as he said, I was born too late. He's born 1923, and people see me, they say, oh, you look really good. And I was like, I'm not born in 1923. But he said I missed everything. But I did hear plenty of music in the 60s. But no, I knew who he was, and everybody had his records on Blue Note. But in person, it was quite overwhelming because he had such a big sound and unique sound, and you know, it was just, I mean, he was great, but we knew who he was.
Mm-hmm. And eventually, you literally became married to the music. You literally made that part of your life. So what was it like dealing with someone he'd had been sidelined by drugs at some point in his life in the 1950s? He became part of the African-American expat community in Europe in the 60s. And then in the 80s, he became sort of a movie idol with the movie Round Midnight. So mm-hmm. What was it like kind of living with a legend?
Well, he didn't consider himself a legend. I mean, his idea was to have a normal life, you know, his version of normal, where you have breakfast at the same time every day, the 3-minute egg, and tried to live a regular life. And he read books, and he liked baseball, and he practiced every day. And then, you know, we traveled, we went on the road, we had a house in Mexico. I mean, the movie star moment lasted about a year, and when it was over, he was like, could we just go back and live our regular lives? And he never was impressed with fame or fortune or
with the bright
that.
Lights.
He was, you know, this mm-hmm. was a musician. He was, were, you know, he wanted to play the saxophone. That was his goal.
And he started actually writing this autobiography, Sophisticated Giant, and you made a promise to him that you would finish that vision for him. It took you 28 years.
Well, that's, I mean, I didn't work on it every day.
But still, what a commitment.
People say, oh, how long did it take? Well, you know, it takes as long as it takes. I have to go to graduate school and learn how to do historical research in African-American history so I could write the proper book. And so it did take longer than. When you make a promise, be careful what you promise. He said, if I don't finish this book, promise you'll finish it. And I said, oh, yeah, no problem.
Well, why did you think it was important to go back and study and become pretty much a jazz impresario and learn the history?
No, I'm not a jazz impresario. Thank you, though. I became when I started looking at his life, and he talked about his family history, I realized it really, to write about it, you had to learn how to write, how to do research methods. So I went, Robin Kelly was my PhD advisor. He wrote the very great biography of Thelonious Monk. He's one of the great scholars of African-American history. And, you know, I didn't want to write just a standard jazz biography, which might be, he's born, he went on the road with Lionel Hampton, he made these records, he made a movie, he died. You know, I wanted to really put him in the context of the cultural history that he came up in. His father was the second black doctor in Los Angeles. I mean, how does that affect his thinking and who he was? And so, you know, it just was a bigger story then, and I needed the skills, and that's why it took me a long time.
He passed away in 1990 at the age of 67, and since then, after that time, you began working on the book. But for many people, what they remember most, other than the music, was that movie, Round Midnight. Why do you think it's still considered such such a film that is the essence of jazz? Why does it stand out so?
I've been thinking about that because on his birthday in Brooklyn, they're showing Round Midnight, and the director, Bertrand Tavernier, is coming, and my son is introducing the movie. I'll be at Mills College on his birthday celebrating. But what Bertrand Tavernier said, you never know which film is going to become last and be considered a classic. And he didn't realize when he made it the impact. And it's shown all over the world. I mean, I've been to Madagascar. They had a screening. I mean, all over Europe, all over the States. The people say it's their favorite jazz film. It's the best jazz film. And then, you know, Dexter's performance was good enough to get him nominated for an Oscar, but even people that don't know about jazz love the film. And I know the Italian Oscar,
I'm going to take let
David,
you take
mm-hmm. Go ahead. Donatello, and the people they asked him, was that you playing? So they considered him an actor rather than a jazz musician making a movie.
Because he did a great job of acting. You know, I was surprised at how those skills translated. Speaking of Mills College, you'll be at Mills on February 27th, Wednesday, at Lisser Hall for a birthday celebration for Dexter Gordon. And you're going to be interviewed by some...
Yeah, looking forward to it. Yeah, Marcus Shelby and Ricky Stevenson and lots of guests and music and... in celebration.
What is his connection to the Bay Area?
Well, when he was first talking about coming back from Europe after 14 years, it was 70. He came back. I have to get this right. He was 14 years in Europe, 62 to 76, and then he wanted to come back. And so he gave me the names of some people who might give him a gig, and the first one was Todd Barkin at the Keystone Corner. And Todd Barkin championed Dexter and the club, and Dexter played there every year on New Year's and these special events, and he, you know, was so helpful to Dexter, and they became very good friends. And so Dexter loved to come to the Bay Area, would come for weeks at a time, and so, you know, I'm very familiar with it. And then Bobby Hutcherson was living there in Montara, and his son grew up with my son, and, you know, we're very connected in that area, so I'm really looking forward to coming back.
Well, folks can hear you read from your biography, Sophisticated Giant, on Wednesday, February 27th at Mills College, Lisser Hall. It's a birthday celebration for Dexter Gordon, and it's a benefit. So you'll be interviewed by Ricky Stevenson and Marcus Shelby and Belva Davis. And if folks want tickets, go to brownpapertickets.com. Maxine Gordon, thank you so much, and thanks for your work.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Thanks, Maxine. Maxine Gordon.
And thank you, Renee Camp, going out with the classic Dexter Gordon, Round Midnight. In addition to Maxine celebrating the birthday of Dexter Gordon at Mills College on the 27th of February, she'll be at the Museum of the African Diaspora here in San Francisco on Thursday, the 28th at 6:30 p.m. Dexter Gordon, Round Midnight. Well, from one of the founders of the bebop style of
jazz music, we go to the founder of Impressionism, but of the visual sort, Claude Monet. Here's Peter Robinson with a review of the de Young's new exhibit. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And we're going to put the clock back from that music about 50 years, because the exhibition that includes the Claude Monet paintings is actually covering the last years of his life. So we're looking essentially at paintings from 1913 to 1926. And I say this because earlier last year they did do the early years. And I think there's a real advantage to going through each room. There's four different rooms and an introductory room at a time. So what is it we're seeing here, and what was Monet doing, and what was the state of his health and his well-being? Well, in 1913, just as war was about to break out in 1914, he stays essentially in his garden. That's the garden at Giverny. And he had eight full-time gardeners, so he was totally preoccupied with the nature there. And as an introduction, there is a old black-and-white film of him painting from very early days of movie-making. And then you go into the first room, which gives us a general layout of most of his paintings. So this is where you're going to get scenes of flower beds, footpaths, bridges, willows, wisteria, and, of course, most famous of all, the water lilies. Now, this time in his life was in many ways a tragic period. His second wife had just died. His son in 1914 would die. And then, of course, the outbreak and the trauma of World War One. And where he was painting from, he could hear the trains carrying the troops to the Western Front. He could probably hear the gunfire. And I think later in 1918, and I'll speak about The Weeping Willow, I think he captures some of this in his painting. Now, the other thing to know about the last years of Claude Monet is that his eyesight was failing, and he did suffer with cataracts. He had his first operation around this period, and then a second one in 1924. And I know art historians essentially see the development in his style from Impressionism to something slightly different as a result of re-seeing things. But I also did ask a question to the main curator as to whether with cataracts you do see colours differently, you also see moving objects differently. So there is that medical fact which I think one wants to take into account. And to me, the great way of viewing a Monet painting, if you have the opportunity, is to literally sit on a chair, on a bench, they have them there, and let the painting come to you. I think the slowness you feel, because he was interested in reflections on the water, he was really interested in the different colour of the lilies, and, of course, all the surrounding flowers, the irises, which he has a full room of his iris paintings. The other thing of interest, there are some particular paintings in this exhibition which came from his home in Paris, and these do not have his signature on. They never got put on the market, they never got auctioned. So, again, you're getting the inside and the outside of the house from the painter's point of view. He ends his life by the time Cubism has come in, and I always liked his remark, how I suffer, how painting makes me suffer and tortures me, the pain it causes me. And then he finishes by saying, and of course Cubism really makes me angry. So if you want a peaceful, almost Zen-type moment, take a trip down to the de Young. Allocate at least a couple of hours so that you can enjoy going from one phase of his life to the next. And there are in total 50 different paintings on display. It's a great way to get in touch with how France went from the time of La Belle Epoque to really what was the beginning of modernism. That's the Claude Monet show, the later years at the de Young Museum.
We should mention that the exhibit does open this Saturday and on Saturday at 2 p.m. Lecture, Monet, the Late Years, will be held by George Shackelford from the Kimball Art Museum in discussion with Melissa Burren from the De Young.
And I think just one footnote to this, the new director, Tom Campbell, he explained that starting in April, every Saturday at either the Legion of Honor or the De Young for San Francisco residents, entry is free. Now, that does not include the special exhibitions, but if you want to really treat yourself to a day out at a collection of really great paintings, take advantage of Saturdays after April.
deyoung.famsf.org for more information about everything happening at the De Young and the other family museums.
Now, for a different type of art, Humanities West is celebrating the 500 years of Leonardo da Vinci's legacy. And this is a two-day event, Friday and Saturday, starting February the 22nd and 23rd. It involves scholars from Stanford, scholars from Oxford, and they're looking at the full range of da Vinci's work, both as a painter, as a scientist, as a writer, and I always see him also as a philosopher. So this isn't a great opportunity to come together with people who've made a lifetime study of him. And I do have a suggestion that if you are interested in Leonardo da Vinci, last year I reviewed Walter Isaacson's biography. It's called Leonardo. And he not only has a beautifully illustrated book, some of the pictures of the Last Supper and things like this, the Mona Lisa, they are all part of Walter Isaacson's book. So it's a great way to get in touch with what effectively will be explored in detail by such leading people. Paula Finlay, Findlay of Stanford will be talking to Martin Kemp of Oxford about the science and poetry of Leonardo. And then we have from the opera, Clifford Cranmer, San Francisco Opera, he will be putting to music some of the actual lyrics and music that Leonardo wrote. And then finally, as a legacy of what he stood for, the weekend will finish with Deborah Loft from the College of Marin, and she's going to explore Leonardo's artistic legacy, homage and irony. So here you have a great opportunity to discover more about a person who still continues to influence today, one of the great Renaissance thinkers, a scientist, a philosopher, an artist, and above all, a note taker. They're using his original notebooks, which are available on record, to use as the basis for their talks. And that's at Humanities West on Friday and Saturday, February the 22nd and February the 23rd.
Thank you, as always, Peter, for your contributions.
Good to be here. Thank you, David.
That does it for Open Air for this Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2019. Next week, you'll learn about the touring production of Hello, Dolly, which is going to be as part of the SHN Golden Gate Theater's presentation with the legendary Betty Buckley. I'll talk with Horace Vandergelder, or better known as acting name, Louis Stadlin, who plays Horace in the show. I'll also talk with African-American Yiddishist opera singer Anthony Mordecai Tzvi Russell. He's a black former opera singer turned Yiddish vocalist who is creating a new tradition of combining two distinct older ones, African-American spirituals and the music of Jewish Eastern European music. And from the San Francisco Symphony, I'll talk with acclaimed German pianist Lars Vogt about his upcoming performance of Schumann's Piano Concerto. And Ragnar Bohlen will be in to talk about Capella SF. That's next week on Open Air. Open Air is produced by Neil Swinkles. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. I'm David Latulieb. You can email me, david@klw.org. If you've got a show suggestion, an admonition, or just some general praise is welcome as well. Thanks for listening.